Welcome to the GGB podcast. We're doing another in our series of GGB Live here at ICE in Barcelona. And my guest today is Krešimir Spacek, the president of Betfred USA. Krešimir, it's great to see you again. I'm really glad to have you on the podcast today because I've learned a lot from you. I think when we first met, I had zero knowledge of online gaming, and you really helped me fill it in. So I just became aware that you were a professional soccer player.
Yeah, that's true. Look, first, thank you for inviting me, right? It's always been a pleasure to meet you over the years, and I believe that we know each other now for 10 years or so.
Yes, yeah.
It's been a while since our probably first meeting in Atlantic City many years ago. But so I started a career as a professional soccer player and has been pretty good when I was young and signed a first professional contract. And at some point of time, I realized that I'll never be an international star.
Right, sure.
I was good at the same time at a school, and I decided to weigh in between two opportunities and decided that I should pursue rather my academic career and my professional career in business than in sports. And it seems to me that it proved to be a solid decision.
Yeah, I think that worked out for you fine. Yeah. But it would have been nice to be a soccer star. You know, it's kind of like a rock and roll star, which I wanted to be.
Yeah, look, it was a big part of my life, and I love it, and I still enjoy sport, and sport is a big part of my life. But it was a very interesting experience for a couple of years, and I spent all my childhood basically heavily involved in this.
Yes, great. So tell us how then your schooling led to becoming in the gaming business.
Yeah, look, for sports, I actually studied at the University of Kinesiology, which is University of Sports, but I was always very driven by business.
Uh-huh.
I kind of focus on marketing and management of sports, and coming from an entrepreneurial family, and that's how I ended up kind of working for sports organizations. I finished a postgraduate school, which is International Master in Management, Law and Humanities in Sports, which is financed and sponsored by FIFA.
Right.
Very focused on that. And through working in sports in 2006, I kind of get headhunted by, at that time, one of the biggest sports betting company called Bet and Win, which is nowadays bwin and part of the Entain Group. And that's how my career in gaming started, which spans now over 20 years almost.
Sure. And you've been with some of the biggest companies in the business. And now you're with a big company that's based in the UK, Betfred, and you're head of their US division, which, the U.S. market is so strange now. Tell us what's going on with Betfred in the U.S. market right now.
Yeah, look, first on the first question, I've been lucky in my career, right? Worked from some of the biggest brands in the industry, starting with bwin through Full Tilt Poker, Boyd Gaming Group, Rush Street Interactive, Hard Rock International, and Great Canadian Gaming Corporation Canada, and now Betfred, right? Mm-hmm. So I had experience both from Europe and North America. Also worked a bit in Latin America as well. So it's pretty over-encompassing experience, and kind of can look at the markets from different perspective, right? Betfred came in the US very early, right, in 2000.
Right.
They had a very, very ambitious plan, and they managed to get licensed and open in 10 states, right? But with everybody that was coming at that point in time in the market, it was more about rushing into the market without kind of thinking through what does this really mean, right? And this usually resulted with commercial agreements which were probably not sustainable long term, which means from the market access deals to some of the supplier deals, and not really understanding how the US market works and how much actually capital investment you need. They decided 18 months ago to bring me in to evaluate the whole situation and try to find the way forward. After I did the due diligence right with the company and figure out where we stand, the decision has been, okay, we need to revisit all our commercial partnerships. We need to revisit in which markets we believe that we could continue participating, and we need to find kind of unique competitive advantages, if this is possible, for what I would call second or third tier operators, which does not have either brand recognition or economic power or market penetration in some of the leading players in the market, right? Which ultimately resulted that we decided to close all our markets in or states in which we operate in the US beside Pennsylvania. We have a very good partnership with Poarch Creek Indians and with Creek there. We believe that we want to keep this as our foothold now, mm-hmm. and we still have a plan for growth in the US. We work on a very, very unique deal, which we believe will provide a certain competitive advantages, which will allow us to reach sustainability in the US. And if this happens, we're going to continue operating in the market, which is definitely one of the biggest and the greatest markets in this industry.
Sure. Okay, great. So why is it so tough for smaller sports betting operations to get traction in the U.S.? Is it just because DraftKings and FanDuel built that massive database when the DFS explosion happened in the mid-2010s?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both. Like, remember, DFS companies had a fortune to build not only a database, but the brand awareness, right? Mm-hmm. Remember, at one point of time, I believe that they spent around $500 or $600 million in 2018 mm-hmm. or something like this on just advertising the brand and their product.
Right.
So they had a huge brand awareness. They have a database and a product which is very similar, if not the same as a real money gaming, right? Which real money gaming then happened, it was an easy transition for them into that industry, into that vertical, and this basically helped. If you have a brand awareness and database, this helps, and sports betting is all about the economies of scale, right? Mm-hmm. So this is what is happening now. If you have economies of scale, everything is else is easier. Your fixed costs basically translate to as many markets as you operate. You have a better contract with the suppliers. You can strike much better market access deals because your partners on the market access deals are more about, okay, what's the ultimate number that I'm receiving? Right. And from the big players, they're going to receive the biggest number. And you can also utilize the economies of scale in technology and marketing. Right, you can go for a national advertising instead of the local advertising, and you build competitive advantages, increase the profitability margin that you basically deploy to increase again the player base and make a bigger distance between everybody
else.
So when you look at the history of what happened in the US, it's many players understood the size of the market. And they were looking at the market from top down instead of bottom up. Okay, market is going to be 20 billion.
Right.
If I just have 3% of the market, I'm going to make 600 million, right? But nobody really looked into deeply what this 3% has. And US is a bit more complicated than many markets that especially big European companies operated. And it starts with the licensing and regulations. Right. You have to get licensed state by state.
Yeah.
It comes then from technology. You have to have a servers in each and every a state, both you as an operator, but also your supplier, which ultimately increase the cost of operations. Also, human resources are more expensive than the majority of places in the world. And then advertising as well is more expensive than in other places in the world, right? And when you put all of this, ultimately your bottom line is much, much thinner, and that's why you see this profilation basically of two big players and a few followers and then large tail of unsuccessful trials in the United States.
So we've got sports betting now is in most states. What are we up to? Almost 40, I guess.
40, yeah.
Yeah. But we only have 7 states with iGaming. Why don't you think they've made that transition since the states can make more money in taxes from iCasino than sports betting?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things, right? First, there was this big DFS and sports betting culture in the U.S. that has been present for forever, right? And sports betting is something which is more socially acceptable and more socially common, right? It's not perceived as a sort of gambling as maybe casino gambling is, right? So, and it was the first push, right? Everybody was first pushing with the lobbying efforts and focus on the sports, right? So I think that's just the wave.
Right.
Then one state started regulating, also other states has fear of missing out, which was obviously because you said lots of people crossing the borders and betting in a bordering states instead of that tax money basically ending up in your state. But I think with iGaming is a bit more complicated because sports betting was only existing in Nevada at that point of time. Now you have approximately 1,000 brick and mortar casinos in United States, right? These casinos employ tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, actually hundreds of thousands of people in the United States. There is lots of capital investment being put behind these brick and mortar properties. So there is a bit of protectionism on brick and mortar side, because they're protecting the capital investment, they're also protecting all the jobs there.
Right.
That's one thing. The second, casino is not as perceived as easy as sports betting culturally, and takes much more to pass the bill and to get into the law, because there is lots of kind of organizations, institutions that are against gambling in the state, right? And the third thing, there wasn't kind of a joint effort by all the big players to focus on iCasino to make it happen. I think this is changing now. We are going to see it progressing, but it won't be, in my opinion, like a sports betting when you're going to have like 40 states getting, you know, regulated in 3 to 4 years. I think that you're going to see states trickling,
right?
And what will also be a turnkey if you get one state like a New York, right, that pass iGaming, then other potentially states will follow up a bit quicker. But I think it will be probably a 10-year process or longer, 15-year process, then 3-year process to get to that number.
But, you know, when you look at states like New Jersey, which had iGaming first before sports betting, Michigan, which legalized them both at the same time, and of course Pennsylvania as well, I mean, they get most of their revenue, 60% of their revenue from casino, right?
Yeah, I would say that casino market is almost 3 times bigger than the sports betting market, and the amount of the tax dollars that can be earned on this is much bigger. At the same time, look, it's also about the protection of the players and illegal competition. If you look at it right now today and search an online casino or a casino in the US, you can get thousands of the websites that are targeting basically US customers.
Right,
so the resolution is very simple, right? There is lots of tax dollars to be made. There is a players to be protected from illegal operators, and regulators need to look into that direction and find a way how to legalize iCasino, while at the same time looking at the interest of all stakeholders, which is existing brick and mortar properties, which is existing player base, and everybody else who is involved in this process.
Right. So Brazil just legalized sports betting, online sports betting, and seemed to be somewhat of a convoluted process, but now they're up and running, and I think there's still some bumps in the road. What's your evaluation of that market right now?
Yeah, look, it's very different than the United States. In the United States, you had a virgin market. Nothing has been happening for a long, long time.
Sure.
Brazil never stopped, right? Brazil is a market that has been developing for the last 2.5 decades. Mm-hmm. The key players have been already established. This is just basically converting market, already existing market, into now taxable market for the state, basically pockets, right? I think it will be extremely competitive market. I think many people that applied, there was 100-something licenses, of which 60-something was approved. Many of these people won't last more than a couple of years or 3 years. The same thing would happen in the United States. But yeah, it's very exciting, because it's a humongous population that live in that country. There is a huge culture of sports betting there as well. Sports is probably the most appealing entertainment for majority of Brazilians that live there. So it will be a great market, but it's definitely not an easy market.
Right.
And I think it will be dominated by a few players that were already existing there prior to the regulation, right? And you know, I think that the smart strategy, if you think about this strategy, is going through the M&A activities, buying already existing players that exist there, and then bringing synergies, either your technology or your operation or your balance sheet power, to enhance the existing business and achieve success there.
Right. So, there's other countries in South America that already have sports betting, and some of them have iGaming as well. So the next market we're looking at is Asia, I think, and that's really confusing over there, considering that the Philippines just shut down their POGOs market, and none of the other countries out there have legalized it, certainly not China. So what's your evaluation of the Asian market at this point?
Look, we are all looking where the next pockets, right, of growth. Yeah, Latin America is definitely progressing. There are many other markets which are interesting, which are looking into legalizing, or they already legalized, like Peru. Chile has been considering for a couple of years, you know, about the legislation. Mexico is already a big market, but you have also other solid pockets like Argentina and Colombia. and others that are looking into this, right? There are also some pockets of market when you talk in Asia. Asia would be a humongous market, but culturally it's very, very hard
right.
to get things done. So I can't tell much. Of course, if China ever opens up, right. that would be absolutely the biggest market in the world,
yeah.
much bigger even than the United States, but this is not more very likely that this going to happen.
I don't see, of course, I didn't see UAE happening either. So
exactly, right? So
yeah.
you never know.
Right.
You can never say no, but
right.
that, of course, is the golden grail of gaming if it ever happens,
yeah.
right? In other markets, it's what I can only sell in terms of the culture. It's very engraved in terms of the player potential and player value. It's extremely solid market. But for now, we can just sit and wait. Look what's going on in Japan as well.
Yeah,
how
yeah.
long the process is lasting to open just the brick and mortar properties there,
right?
right? What is going to happen with digital in there? But I think there are other markets that are worth of looking at, which is an example, Africa,
yeah.
which is the only continent with a growing population in the next 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a continent that has to catch up when it comes to economical parity
sure,
as well.
Right.
And it has humongous population like Kenya,
yeah.
right, like Nigeria, like South Africa and other markets, which are very, very interesting from a gaming perspective. And as infrastructure grows and as purchasing power of the population grows, these markets are going to be extremely interesting, right? And Middle East as well, which
yeah.
is basically mostly based on VIP power and individuals which can spend large amounts of money for entertainment,
right?
right.
For sure. So what do you stand on the cannibalization topic? You know, Cornish Gaming came out and opposed online gaming in Maryland because they said it would harm their land-based facilities there. They pointed to, their Maryland property when they legalized sports betting, said they lost a lot of their retail sports bettors. Do you think that's really happening, or do you think there's a misperception by Cordish at this point?
Yeah, look, last 10 years of my career prior to I joined to Betfred, I spent in large entertainment casino companies in United States,
mm-hmm.
right? Many of them has property throughout United States and international as well. And my job was basically to do this transformation from brick and mortar company
right.
into an omni-channel digital
right, right.
future as well. So we all know the digital is coming. We all know the digital is future and it's inevitable,
right?
We just have to, it's just gonna happen one way
yeah.
or another. So I think that the question, does it cannibalize it or not? It's not the question. It's the question is like, it's unstoppable,
right?
So what do you do about this? On one side, you have these big investments, capital heavy investments in brick and mortar properties, and you have a sizable amount of people that support these properties, right, which creates also economic value and everything. But another, we understand that people are just getting used to do everything digitally, from
sure.
shopping to doctor's visit to you name it,
right.
and we do it digitally right
yeah.
now. So what I am saying is that we have to understand that you cannot stop the digital
right.
development,
mm-hmm.
right? And we need to figure out how these two verticals can work together,
yeah.
right? But the definitely digital gaming is slowing growth of the brick and mortar gaming.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's visible
yeah.
in majority of the states. Look
right.
at New Jersey, look at Michigan, look at
sure.
Pennsylvania. But when you look at this accumulation and what they bring together, it's
just
basically like, sizable growth. It's
yeah.
a big pot, right?
right? Yeah.
And in any business, you know, we can talk about the retail businesses that haven't evolved into digital sphere, and
right.
some of these businesses will stop existing, but there are retail businesses that turn into also a digital multi-powers
right.
using their brand and economic power to become a party in that industry. So if I have to look into this, it's basically from a couple of perspectives, from a state regulator, in consumer perspective, digital is good because
right.
it's another proposition that makes it easy for you to participate in,
right.
right? And it's convenient for you to participate in. From a brick and mortar perspective, hopefully you know, they get some kind of a protection, which could be done in variety of ways, either tethering licensing to these existing businesses so they can create some generate revenues from digital business, or they deciding to participate in digital business directly through the B2C operations, or ultimately using that capital that they have and buying some of the digital companies and integrating them into their system. Some companies are doing well with this. Hard Rock is doing this, Bali is doing this, Caesars, MGM, so it's not impossible, right?
But I always think that the guys on the land-based side don't really pay much attention to the online side, and I think they could do a lot more to attract those online players into their land-based players, maybe giving away free rooms or, you know, free meals or free play, you know, for that matter.
In some of my previous postings that I did where I was kind of a connection between brick and mortar and digital, right. We need a lot of this, right? The idea is to create omnichannel, and everybody's talking about this omnichannel. What does it mean? I mean, right. it's very, very simple, right? What you're doing is, first, player has a one single registration.
Right.
You know, being that you come to brick and mortar players desk and sign up, or you sign up digitally, you're the same player, which is part of our organization, right?
It took them a very long time to put them together.
The second is the loyalty program,
right.
Which has some complications, right? Mm-hmm. Because, an example, when it comes to slots, return to players on the land-based casino are very different to return of the players digitally,
that's
which are around 4%, mm-hmm. and retail could be 8%. To who knows how many percent. So you have to count into this, but it's nothing which is impossible. It's just a simple math. And then it's also money movement. Mm-hmm. You know, moving money from brick and mortar online and online to brick and mortar. Also not impossible, right? And then the fourth one is content.
Yeah.
Right, you can kind of cross promote the content, similar content between basically brick and mortar and everything. But it's more about, I've been doing this for 20, 30 years, it's hard to comprehend the digital world, or digital guys, I've been doing this for 20 years, how to perhaps. So you need to have somebody who understand both worlds and put these two ties together. Once you do this, actually it works very well.
Yeah.
Not every retail customer is gonna play online, not every online customer is gonna play retail, but there is a certain crossover between these two verticals, and just having an ability to know, let's say that I'm a digital player, that I could ultimately earn myself enough loyalty points to go and visit a resort somewhere and spend a weekend there, or visit a concert or a different event there, is a great kind of benefit for the player,
right? Yeah.
And also for the player that comes to the retail property, but it's maybe 100 miles away or 1,000 miles away from that property, but can stay connected with that organization, but using the digital means, is also a huge benefit.
Right.
So it's extremely complementary if it is done well, but to be done well, you have to have the support from the top.
Right.
And top means basically the board, the shareholders, the senior executive team, and then this basically is funneled through the whole organization.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you just taught me a lot more during this session, so I think people can see why you have such a great depth of knowledge. So thanks for taking the time, Krishmir. It's great to see you, and let's stay in touch, and you've got another new adventure coming down the road at some point, I'm sure, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you, Roger. Always a pleasure talking to you.
To read more about the topic presented in this week's podcast, visit ggbmagazine.com. To subscribe to GGB's executive summary, go to ggbnews.com and sign up. Don't miss any edition of the GGB podcast. Subscribe on Spotify, Amazon, or Apple Podcasts today. So we'll see you next time on the GGB podcast.